but I could understand why. "Because, somehow, I have become impervious to it," I told her. "She hypnotized you before we came down here today, to make sure you would do your duty. I saw her do it." I wanted to confess to the surveyor, to tell her how I had become impervious, but believed that that would be a mistake.
"And you did nothing? If this is even true?"
At least she was considering the possibility of believing me. Perhaps some residue, some fuzziness from the episode had stuck in her mind. I didn't want the psychologist to know that she couldn't hypnotize me, and I had wanted to come down here. The surveyor stood there for a moment, considering.
"Believe me or don't believe me," I said, "but believe this. When we go up there, we need to be ready for anything. We may need to restrain or kill the psychologist because we don't know what she's planning." "Why would she be planning anything?" the surveyor asked.
Was that disdain in her voice or just fear again?
"Because she must have different orders than the ones we got," I said, as if explaining to a child.
When she did not reply, I took that as a sign that she was beginning to acclimate to the idea.
"I'll need to go first, because she can't affect me, and you'll need to wear these. It might help you resist the hypnotic suggestion."
I gave her my extra set of earplugs. She took them hesitantly.
"No," she said. "We'll go up together at the same time."
"That isn't wise," I said.
"I don't care what it is. You're not going to go up top without me. I'm not waiting there in the dark for you to fix everything."
I thought about that for a moment, then said,
"Fine. But if I see that she's starting to coerce you, I'll have to stop her."
"Or at least try."
"If you're right," the surveyor said, "if you're telling the truth."
"I am." She ignored me, said,
"What about the body?"
Did that mean we were agreed? I hoped so. Or maybe she would try to disarm me on the way up. Perhaps the psychologist had already prepared her in this regard.
"We leave the anthropologist here. We can't be weighed down. And we also don't know what contaminants we might bring with us."
The surveyor nodded. At least she wasn't sentimental. There was nothing left of the anthropologist in that body, and we both knew it. I was trying very hard not to think of the anthropologist's last moments alive, of the terror she must have felt as she continued trying to perform a task that she had been willed to do by another, even though it meant her own death.
What had she seen? What had she been looking at before it all went dark?
Before we turned back, I took one of the glass tubes strewn around the anthropologist. It contained just a trace of a thick, flesh-like substance that gleamed darkly golden. Perhaps she had gotten a useful sample after all, near the end. As we ascended toward the light, I tried to distract myself. I kept reviewing my training over and over again, searching for a clue, for any scrap of information that might lead to some revelation about our discoveries. But I could find nothing. Could only wonder at my own gullibility in thinking that I had been told anything at all of use. Always the emphasis was on our own capabilities and knowledge base. Always, as I looked back, I could see that there had been an almost willful intent to obscure, to misdirect, disguised as concern that we not be frightened or overwhelmed. The map had been the first form of misdirection. For what was a map but a way of emphasizing some things and making other things invisible? Always we were directed to the map, to memorizing the details on the map. Our instructor, who remained nameless to us, drilled us for 6 long months on the position of the lighthouse relative to the base camp, the number of miles from one ruined patch of houses to another, the number of miles of coastline we would be expected to explore, almost always in the context of the lighthouse, not the base camp. We became so comfortable with that map, with the dimensions of it, and the thought of what it contained, that it stopped us from asking why, or even what. Why this stretch of coast? What might lie inside the lighthouse? Why was the camp set back into the forest, far from the lighthouse, but fairly close to the tower, which of course did not exist on the map? And had the base camp always been there?
What lay beyond the map? Now that I knew the extent of the hypnotic suggestion that had been used on us, I realized that the focus on the map might have been itself an embedded cue, that if we did not ask questions, it was because we were programmed not to ask questions, that the lighthouse, representative or actual, might have been a subconscious trigger for a hypnotic suggestion, and that it might also have been the epicenter of whatever had spread out to become Area X. My briefing on the ecology of that place had had a similar blinkered focus. I had spent most of my time becoming familiar with the natural transitional ecosystems, with the flora and fauna and the cross-pollination I could expect to find. But I had also had an intense refresher on fungi and lichen that, in light of the words on the wall, now stood out in my mind as being the true purpose of all of that study. If the map had been meant solely to distract, then the ecology research had been meant, after all, to truly prepare me, unless I was being paranoid. But if I wasn't, it meant they knew about the tower, perhaps had always known about the tower. From there my suspicions grew. They had put us through grueling survival and weapons training, so grueling that most evenings we went right to sleep in our separate quarters. Even on those few occasions when we trained together, we were training apart. They took away our names in the second month, stripped them from us. The only names applied to things in Area X, and only in terms of their most general label. This, too, a kind of distraction from asking certain questions that could only be reached through knowing specific details. But the right specific details, not, for example, that there were 6 species of poisonous snakes in Area X. A reach, yes, but I was not in the mood to set aside even the most unlikely scenarios. By the time we were ready to cross the border, we knew everything. And we knew nothing. The psychologist wasn't there when we emerged, blinking into the sunlight, ripping off our masks, and breathing in the fresh air. We had been ready for almost any scenario, but not for the psychologist's absence. It left us adrift for a while, afloat in that ordinary day, the sky so brightly blue, the strand of trees casting long shadows. I took out my earplugs and found I couldn't hear the beating of the tower's heartbeat at all. How what we had seen below could coexist with the mundane was baffling. It was as if we had come up too fast from a deep sea dive, but it was the memories of the creatures we had seen that had given us the bends. We just kept searching the environs for the psychologist, certain she was hiding, and half hoping we would find her, because surely she had an explanation. It was, after a time, pathological to keep searching the same area around the tower, but for almost an hour we could not find a way to stop. Finally, I could not deny the truth. "She's gone," I said. "Maybe she's back at the base camp," the surveyor said. "Would you agree that her absence is a sign of guilt?" I asked. The surveyor spat into the grass, regarded me closely. "No, I would not. Maybe something happened to her. Maybe she needed to go back to the camp." "You saw the footprints. You saw the body." She motioned with her rifle. "Let's just get back to base camp." I couldn't read her at all. I didn't know if she was turning on me or just cautious. Coming up above ground had emboldened her regardless, and I had preferred her uncertain. But back at base camp, some of her resolve crumbled again. The psychologist wasn't there. Not only wasn't she there, but she had taken half of our supplies and most of the guns. Either that or buried them somewhere, so we knew the psychologist was still alive. You must understand how I felt then, how the surveyor must have felt. We were scientists, trained to observe natural phenomena and the results of human activity. We had not been trained to encounter what appeared to be the uncanny. In unusual situations, there can be a comfort in the presence of even someone you think might be your enemy. Now, we had come close to the edges of something unprecedented, and less than a week into our mission, we had lost not just the linguist at the border, but our anthropologist and our psychologist. "Okay, I give up," the surveyor said, throwing down her rifle and sagging into a chair in front of the anthropologist's tent as I rummaged around inside of it. "I'm going to believe you for now. I'm going to believe you because I don't really have a choice, because I don't have any better theories. What should we do now?" There still weren't any clues in the anthropologist's tent. The horror of what had happened to her was still hitting me. To be coerced into your own death. If I was right, the psychologist was a murderer, much more so than whatever had killed the anthropologist. When I didn't answer the surveyor, she repeated herself with extra emphasis. "So what the hell are we going to do now?" Emerging from the tent, I said, "We examine the samples I took, we develop the photographs, and go through them. Then tomorrow, we probably go back down into the tower." The surveyor gave a harsh laugh as she struggled to find words. Her face seemed to almost want to pull apart for a second, perhaps from the strain of fighting off the ghost of some hypnotic suggestion. Finally, she got it out. "No, I'm not going back down into that place. And it's a tunnel, not a tower." "What do you want to do instead?" I asked. As if she'd broken through some barrier, the words now came faster, more determined. "We go back to the border and await extraction. We don't have the resources to continue. And even if you're right, the psychologist is out there right now plotting something, even if it's just what excuses to give us. And if she's not, if she's dead or injured because something attacked her, that's another reason to get the hell out." She had lit a cigarette, one of the few we'd been given. She blew two long plumes of smoke out of her nose. "I'm not ready to go back," I told her. "Not yet." I wasn't near ready, despite what had happened. "You prefer this place. You really do, don't you?" the surveyor said. It wasn't really a question. A kind of pity or disgust infused her voice. "You think this is going to last much longer? Let me tell you, even on military maneuvers designed to simulate negative outcomes, I've seen better odds." Fear was driving her, even if she was right. I decided to steal my delaying tactics from the psychologist. "Let's just look at what we brought back, and then we can decide what to do. You can always head back to the border tomorrow." She took another drag on the cigarette, digesting that. The border was still a 4-day hike away. "True enough," she said, relenting for a moment. I didn't say what I was thinking, that it might not be that simple, that she might make it back across the border only in the abstract sense that my husband had, stripped of what made her unique. But I didn't want her to feel as if she had no way out. I spent the rest of the afternoon looking at samples under the microscope, on the makeshift table outside of my tent. The surveyor busied herself with developing the photographs in the tent that doubled as a darkroom, a frustrating process for anyone used to digital uploads. Then, while the photos were resting, she went back through the remnants of maps and documents the prior expedition had left at the base camp. My samples told a series of cryptic jokes with punchlines I didn't understand. The cells of the biomass that made up the words on the wall had an unusual structure, but they still fell within an acceptable range. Or those cells were doing a magnificent job of mimicking certain species of saprotrophic organisms. I made a mental note to take a sample of the wall from behind the words. I had no idea how deeply the filaments had taken root, or if there were nodes beneath and those filaments were only sentinels. The tissue sample from the hand-shaped creature resisted any interpretation, and that was strange, but told me nothing, by which I mean I found no cells in the sample, just a solid amber surface with air bubbles in it. At the time, I interpreted this as a contaminated sample or evidence that this organism decomposed quickly. Another thought came to me too late to test, that, having absorbed the organism's spores, I was causing a reaction in the sample. I didn't have the medical facilities to run the kinds of diagnostics that might have revealed any further changes to my body or mind since the encounter. Then there was the sample from the anthropologist's vial.
I had left it for last for the obvious reasons. I had the surveyor take a section, put it on the slide, and write down what she saw through the microscope.